If I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly the river to the one I love. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
Hi, you're listening to the Laser Blast Film Podcast. My name's Justin McClue, and this is a little bit of a different format than we've done in the past. I'm here today with...
Pierce Sturks.
And it's January 2nd, 2014, and while we haven't watched a film that we're going to discuss today, we're going to go through our top tens, or to be more specific, the top five, and then our alternative top five, and some of the disappointments that we saw during the year. Now, usually our podcasts are a little bit more energetic and we're all laughing and it's, you know, chaos. We're going for a little bit more structure here and a little bit more calmer voices than my usual screeching and giggling. So, what do you think 2013 was as a film year, Pierce?
To be honest, it was a damn good year for films. Mm-hmm. I mean, the past, just the December alone, like so many movies, I went to see like six movies in theaters and all of them just blew me away. The first half of the year was a little bit slow. Of course, summer is always occupied by the traditional just like summer like superhero fair, but just really the fall and winter season of 2013 just kind of it honestly did blow me away. It's one of the best kind of years I think we've had for cinema in that regard in a long time.
I think that it's very difficult to argue anyone to say like 2013 was a bad year for film. Like often people like to go at the end year end list and say like this was terrible, we didn't get any good films. But I don't think anyone has any argument to say that there were some really good films that came out this year. And it's one of the reasons that our top 10 list, which you can find on the Laser Blast Film Society Facebook page, join us. We'd be happy to add you. There's a lot of crossover, like a lot of top 10 lists. You know, I've seen some really weird ones. Some have included Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, that one I don't understand. But you know, as a whole, the reason why I think you do keep seeing some of these films just pop up over and over again, it's not because it's like people are being unoriginal. It's just like that stands, you know, as a testament to the quality of these films is the fact that they've been able to reach, you know, like such a diverse audience. Where so many people, like, it doesn't matter what type of films that they usually like, that these films, they're still just like, you know what, that was a damn good movie. Mm.
So there was a lot of crossover between me and Pierce's lists. So what I did was I broke it into a regular top five and an alternative top five. I'll go from each one as we go along, but we can start right from Pierce's kind of top five. We have This Is the End, the comedy directed by... Seth Rogen and Ethan, oh, I forgot what his last name is. Uh-oh, I hope he doesn't listen to this. Which was a comedy that came out...
Evan Goldberg,
that everyone thought was going to be absolutely terrible.
This was a film like... This film wouldn't typically be in my top five, but it's in my top ten, but we're including it just because of all the duplicates that we have. But yeah, This Is the End. This was a film that I went into with absolutely no expectations. I thought it was just going to be one of those kind of absurd premise films like Pineapple Express, where it's just like, you know, these guys doing their shtick and being funny with it. What I did not expect was to go into like probably the funniest film that I saw all year. Mm-hmm. And also surprisingly, you know, a very tight script that, you know, deals with themes such as like friendship and growing older and just like
changing.
Yeah. And changing and like what's a good change and like what are bad changes and just, you know, like human relationships. I wasn't expecting to have a film, you know, with like giant, like devil dicks also have, you know, such resounding things to say about friendship and just like,
I think many people may call this blasphemy, but, what good film to compare it to is Ghostbusters, because while both films are comedies, they also treat their fantastical aspects with a seriousness within the context of the comedy. Like when the monsters show up and This Is the End, no matter how ridiculous things have been before, they're still a threat and they will kill people.
Yeah, no, there are some great monster designs in the movie too. That's the thing too, is like most of the time, the monsters aren't played for laughs. They aren't played for jokes. It's played more as just like, you know, these
there are giant dicks.
Yeah, but... like there are that, but the comedy is mostly played with like these screw up characters going through like their own problems, being surrounded by like these horrible, horrible atrocities, just like these monsters and just like, you know, the apocalypse. They're just surrounded by that. And the humor comes from like how these screw-ups have to try to deal with their newfound situation.
And while everyone's really funny in the movie, I want to give props to Jay Baruchel, who has the sad job of having to play the straight man to all these comedians. And every review I read rarely mentions him because that's the task that he's...
Well, the straight man is usually always such a... It's usually such a thankless role because it's the role where... You have to be the audience. You have to be the audience and be like kind of the normal one, the one that's the voice of reason, the one that's kind of, you know, voicing the audience's concerns, but at the same time still be someone that the audience can get behind enough to kind of follow through the adventure. And it's like the main two protagonists here are Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel.
Jay Baruchel, yeah.
Those are the two that kind of just like keep everything together.
And Danny McBride comes in to steal the show for his moment. And Jonah Hill does a really funny shtick as like a nice guy that's a bit of a jackass. And finally we have James Franco.
Yes.
Playing James Franco.
It's been a good year for, going a little bit off subject, but it's been a good year for James Franco and Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill, yeah. Jonah Hill was in Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah.
He also does another great performance. It's also that kind of same, just kind of, he's good with those types.
Yeah, the
he's
nice kind of jackass kind of roles. And which brings us to our alternative top five, which in the fifth place, we have Spring Breakers, which me and Pierce actually only saw like a few days ago for the first time.
That was the last film that we watched of 2013.
We watched it on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And do you think it was surprising? Like, you wanted to see it for a long time. I personally really enjoyed it from even just a visual, like, aesthetic level. But even after it ended and we talked about it, that there's definitely more going on in this film. And I've been listening to some critics be confused by it. They're not sure if it's a parody or if it's, you know, if it really has anything to say. I think that it's, you know, the messages and themes are pretty out in the open.
Yeah, it was a film that I've been wanting to see after after a TIFF of last year where
a lot of jackasses put it on their top 10 of that year. So it feels like a long time ago, 2012.
Yeah, but no, it was a film that, like, here's the thing that everyone told me about. It was just like, I really liked it, but I don't know if you'll like it.
Yeah.
That's what I kept hearing from all these different people. It was just the fact that it's just like, oh, it was great. I loved it. Like, I'm not really sure if it's up your alley or if it's just like your type of film.
So Robert Mitchum's not in it.
Hey, come on. Who doesn't love Robert Mitchum? But, no, it was one where I'm like, finally got down to see it. It's just, I'm having a brain fart here. Harmony Korine. Yeah. It's just kind of the tone that he's able to establish and just kind of this bizarre universe that he, you know, just sets out from like the first frames of the film. It's just, it sucks you into this world that is so insane and just like so screwed up with such absurd characters. But the fact it speaks such volumes about just kind of that world on its own. Like, the film is played out in this kind of neon nightmare, just kind of presentation. It's abstract. It's surreal. It's also extremely over the top, but it's one of those really hard lines to draw where it's trashy at the same time as being kind of like an air of class to it, as it is being completely absurd, as it is being, you know, a really strong satire and having a lot of things to say.
I think something that's really important in this film is that there's definitely intent behind it. Now, yes. I'm not very familiar with Harmony Korine's other film like Gummo or Julian Donkey Boy or Trash Humpers. And to be honest, I haven't really been interested that much in the work that he's put out before. Maybe I need to go revisit it. I know I have friends that really love it, like Adam Thorne. He's a huge Harmony Korine fan. And I think that something else that's interesting about this film is how infectious it was to the populace and how much it was almost like a virus. Because it made $30 million at the box office.
People, like, the people that did see this film, like, for a lot of people, it's like I've seen lists where it's their number one film. It's a film where, like, it's only been a couple of days since I've watched it, but, like, I've been thinking about it. There are just certain scenes that just kind of still keep resonating in my mind that I just want to go back to because it's just such a weird trip of a movie that it's one that I do think you will kind of continually notice things when you go back to it and just kind of pick up on additional sort of layers and just keep going along for the ride.
Speaking of scenes, it's kind of funny that this is a movie that almost its scenes all kind of blend in together. And yeah. It is like a big music video due to the repetition and the...
Well, it's also got a bit of a non-linear style to it where yeah. it jumps back and forth and it helps. It's not so much of just like... It doesn't feel like, oh, we don't know really how to tell this story, so we're just going to kind of jump around mm-hmm. from place to place. I think it does just a really good job at just kind of the contrast between the two worlds of just kind of the insane nightmare like fantasy Spring Break, yeah. of Spring Break and also
boring college.
Yeah, the boring college life, which is, you know, supposedly the normal ideal world
that you want to get away from.
Yeah.
How would you feel if Harmony Korine, like, there's actually a commentary track on the DVD. If he's like, we didn't know what we were doing and we just kind of like put it all together and improvised it.
Yeah, you see, there have been films where, like, I've seen people go just like, oh, you know, this is a great movie. But at the same time, like, I have heard the directors go and say, just like, we have no idea what we were
Does
doing.
Does that ruin it for you, or?
It doesn't, but I honestly don't think that's the case here. Like, mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, it does ruin it for you when you hear that just, like, the parts of a movie that were the greatest parts were completely unintentional.
Yeah.
It's just like, no, that's exactly what I didn't want to do. That, of course, always, you know, it kind of helps to ruin the illusion. But no, I think Spring Breakers, it was made with an intent, and like they succeeded with
what even if they just grabbed all the pieces of footage randomly and they were happy with what they got, the way that it was put together,
yeah.
there's a definite intent, and I'm not going to say message because I can't speak on the behalf mm-hmm. of the filmmakers, but there's definitely an idea that they're trying to like subversiveness and satire is like the word of the day today. And we haven't even talked about James Franco,
yeah.
which oh, who was God. Like the,
his performance is alien. Like, oh my, it's just, this honestly I can say is the film that just kind of made me go. Because to be honest, before with James Franco, he was just one of those guys. I'm like, whatever.
Well, James Franco, yeah, I heard another podcast. They're talking about that James Franco is best in the roles when he gets to lose himself yeah. in them. Or when he gets to do something weird is usually a twist on his persona. Mm-hmm. When he's forced to play it like a straight guy in like, what was it, the Planet of the Apes film that came out?
Yeah,
that's where it suffers.
It's those roles where I don't, it's kind of the same with like Bradley Cooper. Bradley Cooper is an actor where it's just mm-hmm. when he's playing like, oh, look, it's Bradley Cooper playing like some hot, cool dude. It's usually those roles where I'm just like, whatever, I don't really like this guy. But it's when like these guys actually get to act and to, you know, really... you know, digging deep into these characters and mm-hmm. then find something to make interesting and memorable about them that they succeed at. And just, yeah, James Franco's performance is just, it's out there, but it's out there in a way that is just like, I honestly can't see anybody else doing this. And it's one of those roles too, where if someone else did it, and
Danny
it's just,
McBride,
well, it's, that'd have been interesting, but it's a role that's so easy to go from, you know, memorable and entertaining to just absolutely obnoxious
yeah.
and just terrible. And just, it's such
it
a
never
fine
reaches
line.
That point where yeah, you're like, ugh, like I say, like Danny McBride would have played it probably more overtly comedic. Like James Franco's funny in the movie, but he feels like a real kind of funny that you're laughing at like the kind of ridiculous reality of this character as opposed
yeah,
to someone
like what kind of world is this guy living in it? As opposed to just the thing with James Franco's character is that he never feels like he's, you know, part of a joke or
yeah.
he himself is a joke.
Yeah.
It's just a guy that's just like, this is how I live. This is, you know, the world that I've set out for myself. And he just embodies that perfectly. And that's what makes his character just so funny and insane and just so easy to kind of just like, I wonder what the hell this guy's going to do mm-hmm. next. Even though as most of the characters in Spring Breakers are not the best people
mm-hmm.
That you would typically would root for or want to follow for a future.
Speaking of people that you can't really root for, back to the regular top five, on number four, we have Side Effects, a
yes.
film that, Pierce has been, ranting about since you saw it in regular theaters, didn't you? Cause
I saw it in regular theaters. I went and see it by myself. It was one of those films where people are just like, oh yeah, Side Effects is pretty good. You should check it out. So I went to see it. I knew absolutely nothing about it. I hadn't watched a trailer and I went in and I just loved every bit of it. For the longest time, that was my favorite film of the year
mm-hmm.
until, you know, all the kind of the great dramas started coming out later on in the fall. But, oh man, Side Effects is just, it is like one of the classiest pieces of trash cinema that I've seen ever made.
Speaking of people that haven't gone into trailers, I think that one of the things that makes Side Effects so surprising for you is that, you know, this is not a big spoiler, but it's not what you think it is.
No, it's very Hitchcockian in terms of how it likes that it has some twists that are thrown in, but they never feel cheap. It never feels just like, oh, the story's boring now, let's throw something in to mix it up. It's more as it's just, it takes one story and then it turns into another story that's just as interesting, if not more.
Well, you could find it a little jarring because, like, when I went in, I expected it to be like a fast food nation of the pharmaceutical company, but that's not what it is. And it does kind of start that way, and it's leading you down that path before it kind of pulls the rug out under you and becomes something completely different.
But I think what's so great about that is even, you know, the film that you thought it was going to be, it's still the part where it is that film. It's still a good film in that vein.
Well, the characters are still there because at the end of the day, what the film is a character drama.
Yes.
It's not an expose or anything like that, but it's about characters and how they react to the situation. And it's another film that you can easily read into and find a lot of things that are not explicitly said, but are bubbling under the surface.
It's got a lot of commentary and stuff thrown in there. Obviously, like, because this was wasn't this Soderbergh's last theatrical film?
Yes, because Behind the Candelabra was an HBO movie.
Yeah, even so though it got a theatrical distribution in the UK, I think.
Yeah, but technically it was his last. Yeah. Are you a big fan of Soderbergh? Or?
No, actually this was, I've seen one of his films before.
I'm sure, you've probably seen the Oceans movies or Out of Sight or Traffic or Aaron Brockovich or none of those?
I've seen one of the Oceans films, but
Limey.
No, I saw Contagion. Like, I saw Contagion.
Contagion, you didn't like that, I remember.
Contagion, I wasn't that much of a fan of, but Side Effects, it was a film that I went into with kind of no expectations, and I wasn't expecting it to, you know, to jump from genre to genre so effortlessly, but also, you know, be so good at all those different genres. And the cast is great. And can we also, like, going back again to A Year for Actors, Channing Tatum? This is the year that made me like Channing Tatum.
Oh, my God. Well, I've been a fan of Channing Tatum. He has a really good movie that no one has seen called A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints. And he is great in it. But what happened was, I don't know the exact chronology, but I think he got cast into the Step Up roles. And then he kind of fell into that, like, beefy man cake role. And he didn't really have a great chance to show his charisma. But, man, this year he has he had 21 Jump Street, which he was really funny in. He had Magic Mike was 2012, wasn't it?
Magic Mike was last year, I believe. Yeah. Magic Mike and 21 Jump Street were both last year.
Oh, were they? Yeah. But this brings up a good point to bring up a film that me and Pierce will champion. It's not on any of our top 10 lists. White House Down.
White House Down is the best summer blockbuster of 1996 that you never saw.
That came out in 2013.
Yeah, it is. He is just, charisma just oozes from the man's veins in the film. Like, it's not by any means a really good film, but for the film that it sets out to make,
it's so much fun though.
It is so much fun, and it has one of those perfect 90s era action film scripts where everything has a setup, everything has a payoff, but it's cheesy, it's predictable, but it's just so much fun.
And it makes a perfect double bill with Olympus Has Fallen.
Yes, which is
Tonally completely different, but still also an 80s action film along the lines of something like Cobra.
Yeah, I just think it's funny how both of them are basically, you know, kind of diehard movies, but one is like a super ultra violent R-rated, just like Olympus Has Fallen.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, the fun 90s PG-13 action film of Olympus Has Fallen.
Steven Soderbergh is someone that I've always appreciated more as a person, and I respect, because, like, I'm a big fan. He has journals you can read. He has two books, The Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and another one, like, called Getting Away With It. And you see that he's someone that's a real cinephile. He loves arts and, like, discovering things and being influenced by things. But I find it hasn't always translated in the films that he's made, which have always been different and experimental, but something like Haywire, which I thought I would freaking love, I really disliked. And I actually revisited it after Side Effects, being like, maybe I'm going to give it another chance. I still don't like it.
Well, he's so admirable in the fact that he's a guy that's just like, I'm going to just
try this.
I have a goal. I'm going to make movies. I'm not going to limit myself to one genre, because the problem with so many directors is that, like, they are good at one thing, but the problem is they never see if they're good at anything else.
Yeah.
They just keep sticking with what they know. Sometimes it works for them. Sometimes it doesn't. But no, what Side Effects, if...
I think it works because Steven Soderbergh, from my non-academic film perspective, has always been someone who approaches things from a very unemotional place. Mm-hmm. And I think that Side Effects works a lot because, unlike something like Haywire, that when you strip all the emotion and involvement in an action film, you have nothing. In Side Effects, for this particular subject matter, it works perfectly. And that cold, distant look at things is what it...
It helps forces you to connect.
Yeah,
it helps with the story. It helps with the subject and the content of the film. And while it's not the most stylistic like film, and compared to like kind of, you know, De Palma or Hitchcock, where like those guys they love to go crazy with their visual flourishes. But Side Effects, it feels like a very strong kind of like working man's you know, take on this kind of subject matter. But it's so good. All the cast is. Mm-hmm. is fantastic. It's also been a great year for Rooney Mara with her roles. And it's just, it was just so much fun to see and just kind of go on this journey. It probably was the most fun that I had at the cinema this
year. And you saw it alone.
Yeah, I did. And I saw it alone, but it's just, I had absolutely no problem with that because it was just that fun of a ride.
Yeah. I'm going to, on the alternative top five, on number four here, we have Mud, the Matthew McConaughey film, directed by Jeff Nichols, the guy who did Take Shelter and Shotgun Stories. Pierce didn't see this one, so I'm going to take over and just explain why I think it should be a movie that everyone should go out and see. This has definitely been the year of Matthew McConaughey. He stars in Mud as this character that the two children of the story meet and becomes their kind of idol. I'm not going to go into any spoilers. Don't worry, Pierce. So the reason I really like Mud is that it takes one of my favorite genres, which is the child in peril. Now, I know this sounds kind of bad, but children in peril, in my opinion, are a kind of subgenre of film where it's a kid's movie, but it treats the kids with respect and that they can actually be in danger.
Which I wish so many more films would do that. Because another film that we saw this year, Lady in White.
Yeah. An old film.
An older film. It does that quite well. And to be honest, I think even though like this is not a kid's movie, but like kids still go out and like see movies that aren't kid's movies. Kids appreciate it and adults appreciate it when you have a movie that treats kids with respect. Because look at something with like a Stand By Me.
Yeah.
Like films like that where you have characters that, you know, are minors, but you still treat them like adults and you still put them in situations that, you know, do have peril and do have consequences.
It's not even about like killing kids or anything like that. It's just about giving them a movie stakes and making it believable that these children are doing things that they would be afraid of themselves. Because when you take away consequences or you just have like a moral or a lesson, it's difficult for me as an adult or even me as a kid to like really get into it. I think that when I was a kid, like, it's easy to say, like, one of my favorite movies was The Monster Squad. And that is a movie where the kids are dealing with things, as fantastical, like, creatures they are, that could hurt them because they hurt other things and they feel like a threat. And that's why Mud is a movie that I really like, other than the fact that it's really well directed, it's really well acted, the story is great, there's some great morals in it. But it's also a movie that, while it is technically for an adult, I think it may be rated R. It's definitely something that, as a 12-year-old boy, I would have loved, even with its Jeff Nichols like kind of control and style. And I think that more people should go and check it out. You know, it's not like a... It's been described a lot as like a boy's own adventure, and that's basically what it is. But you have to go in expecting a kind of like a leisurely pace, and not expect like a big action extravaganza.
It's a film that I really wanted to see this year, and just I don't know why I hadn't. It was one of those like list out of like three or four films that I still really want to see. I just didn't have a chance to see before the year ended.
Now, let's turn our eyes toward films that disappointed us this year. Now, when we were making this list, I had to specify that these are not movies that we hate. It's easy to hate a bad movie, but to go into a movie with expectations and then to be let down, now that really sucks. But it's interesting to talk about why we were disappointed about this.
And just to know, we're not done with our kind of top five.
No, we're going to get back into it.
We're at the halfway point, so we're just mixing it up a bit.
So Pierce mentioned that he didn't really see that many movies that disappointed him because you rarely go and see films that like you don't really want to see and have a kind of a clout to them?
I did that a lot last year, where it's just like, I'll go see this, but and then just like, why did I see that? Why did I waste my money?
You don't like to take chances.
Well, it's not so much taking chances. Like, if it's a film that I still really want to see, I'll go see it despite any reviews. Mm-hmm. But I do like to kind of see, you know, what the buzz is on something before I, you know, venture out and spend, you know, like my $12 on a ticket.
As opposed to me that consumes like 80% garbage.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't see that many bad movies in theaters. I see mostly bad movies at home. Yeah. By myself in the dark.
That's a good way to do it.
Let's start with a really easy target. Evil Dead. Now, Evil Dead, the remake, is... anyone who knows me and Pierce know that we love Evil Dead. Like, there's no contest about that. And the idea of a remake itself is, like, blasphemy, even though Evil Dead 2 is a remake of Evil Dead 1. And I kind of like the fact that they brought in a first-time filmmaker. He wasn't really, like, a big music video director or anything. And, you know, the first-time filmmaker did things that first-time filmmakers do, which is say, like, oh, we used all practical, and we did all this, and we did all that. And when it played at South by Southwest, it had a really big buzz behind it. People were like, it's the goriest film that I've ever seen.
Yeah, we had tickets to a sneak screening, so it was a couple weeks before, a week or two before it opened.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't too far in advance, but it was far enough in advance where it was just, like, it was a hot item ticket, yeah. like oh god, like, oh my god, you guys are going to see like the new Evil Dead, like, it's supposed to be amazing. And so like I was still a little bit wary, but yeah. I did honestly go in with no kind of, you know, grudges against it for being a remake stuff. I was interested. I was just really interested in seeing this kind of just, you know, dead set, you know, straight faced, serious, you know, just kind of gruesome horror movie, because that concept, if you play it without the dark humor, it could be really, really terrifying. And that's what I heard that it was. I heard that it was, you know, like a female protagonist this time around, and that was, it was going to be interesting. That's what I was looking forward to seeing, you know, a twist on it and something new from the idea.
And I mean, like, we gave a long preamble here, but I don't think anyone's going to be surprised that we thought it fucking sucked. Like, I feel really bad, and I rarely did it, but I was like harumphing and like laughing as this movie was playing.
There are so many moments where I hate to be that guy in the theater too, where it's like a dramatic scene and like someone's laughing in the background.
Yeah,
but this film had so many moments where I'm just like, how can people take any of this seriously? Here's the thing with the old Evil Dead. It's just now, just thinking back to this, it's revving up all these feelings and rants that I had after we saw it the first time. But here's what I don't understand is that the first Evil Dead did such a great and easy job of doing one thing, making you kind of interested in the characters and having it be an experience where it's just like, oh, I wonder what's going to happen next with these characters.
I wouldn't, you know what? I wouldn't even give you that. The characters in Evil Dead are not that interesting, but they're ciphers that you don't spend too much time with them before stuff starts happening.
Exactly. The problem with the characters in this is that, like, the main character is introduced to the audience, and the whole point is that none of her friends like her. Everyone is, like, pissed off at her. Like, it's just, the first, you know, first act of the movie is deliberately trying to make you hate this woman. So when the tables turn and like she's one that you're left with, you're annoyed with her still at this point. You don't like anyone. That's the problem that I have, is that like all the characters were douchey.
Yeah.
They were like either unrelatable. They were annoying. It felt just like your standard teen, just like slasher stereotypes that were tossed in. And I am just so damn tired of that. I am so fucking tired of that.
I think you're giving a little bit too much credit to the original Evil Dead, but like my problems stem. Now, number one, and this is something that I thought about, and the director, you know, that great evil force in Evil Dead number one that's invisible and is everywhere.
Yeah.
Let's physically represent her as a long-haired Japanese ghost, which is already a joke at this point. But you know what? I would bet money that Sam Raimi is the one who brought that in, because Sam Raimi is the one who produced Ju-on and The Grudge. Well, those are the same two movies, but he loves that stuff. But it's such an awful idea. And not only that, I have no problem if you're making Evil Dead and you want to make it dark and like mean. but you can't make it boring. This is a film that is almost devoid of any kind of kinetic energy. Shaking the camera doesn't necessarily mean kinetic energy, because the Halloween films by Rob Zombie are not really that kinetic. They're just kind of dull. And that's what this Evil Dead suffers from. Now, I could talk about a whole podcast of why I didn't like Evil Dead and break it down scene by scene. It does have some cool gore.
But no, the gore itself is fantastic. It's just
not,
you know,
anything that memorable, though.
Yeah, I think the reason why we heard so much buzz and why buzz did get out around it is because you got to remember, horror has been in a slump in terms of traditional Hollywood horror. It's been in a slump in the past, you know, like 3 or 4 years of just PG-13 found footage and exorcism movies. Mm-hmm. Just nothing but those. But that, once again, was kind of my problem with this, is that it basically turned it into just another exorcism movie.
I think that I can sum up my thoughts on The Evil Dead very simply, is that in the second Evil Dead, there's that great scene where Ash makes a chainsaw. Isn't that awesome? When he's like, you know, zooms and he picks up the pieces and he makes a chainsaw. He says a one-liner. So when the filmmaker of Evil Dead, the remake, came to this scene, he's like, how am I going to top this? He has this great montage where he builds a defibrillator. That sums up Evil Dead, the remake, in a nutshell for me. Now, moving on to other films that disappointed Pierce, not necessarily disappointed me, we have Pacific Rim, Guillermo del Toro's big, giant mechs fighting monster movies.
Yes. Pacific Rim, it's a film where I've had it described to me in this way. In terms of, like, kaiju films, Pacific Rim is a great kaiju film. But the problem is, most kaiju films are not that great. You have you've got a couple of, like, really fun sequences, but for most of the time you're sitting around for like 60 minutes looking at your watch waiting for Godzilla or Gamera to pop up and do something cool. But for the rest of it, it's just like you're stuck with boring people doing boring shit, and you're in it for like those fun 20 minutes. Pacific Rim is way better than that, but the problem that I have is that still, after you have all those things, Pacific Rim is just not that great of a movie. It has a lot of really cool ideas, but the problem that I have with that is that those ideas have already been done before in other kaiju films and anime, and they've been done, you know, a little bit more cohesively. And so I just wish that we had a better protagonist that actually had the...
Well, yeah, you know what? Like, I like Pacific Rim, but I have many caveats. I can't even say words. That I want to get off my chest right away. Like, why do two of the fights take place in the water and the rain? Like, why is it... The kaijus all look pretty crappy. Like, it's... they all do... And I have a feeling that the people that worked on the film think these kaiju look awesome.
Like, I have a feeling if you actually stopped and, like, looked at these things and just kind of studied them over, you would see all these awesome kind of subtle differences. But the problem is, when you have these giant monsters on a giant screen just, you know, jumping back and forth in the rain, in the dark, and they're all just kind of these same Del Toro-esque, you know,
open-faced monsters.
Yeah, the problem is that after, you know, the first two, they all fucking look the same.
Yeah.
So it's... And, like, they had, like, these monster class levels, but the problem is just, like, oh, we've got, like, a level 4, but the problem is that it looked the exact same as, like, a level 2.
Yeah, I'll be the first to admit that the most disappointing part of the film is the climax, which is super underwhelming. Like, there's, like, a level 4 monster that just kind of looks like all the other monsters. Like, Ultraman Mega Monster Battle is my favorite kaiju film that I've seen. And that movie ends with a monster showing up made up of like 1,000 different monsters. Yeah. That is like giant, to the point that the big Ultraman are just tiny on him. And that's what this movie needed for a climax. You need to keep accelerating the stakes, especially when you have characters that aren't that charismatic, as are the leads in this movie. Like, I even forget what the main guy's name is. The, you know, bland Australian guy doing an American accent.
The guy from that Sons of Anarchy.
Sons of Anarchy show. Like, he's not that much of a compelling lead. But then you have people like Charlie Day who are interesting, and Ron Perlman.
Yeah, it's filled with a fun supporting cast. But the big problem is that I see the supporting cast, I'm like, I'd much rather have a film revolving around these characters. And it's okay to have the bland, you know, like, everyman lead guy. But the problem is that you have to have the stakes revolving around him be much more interesting and to keep developing at a much more rapid pace for you to actually be interested in what's happening and kind of get behind the character.
This film could use a shot of adrenaline when it comes to its pacing.
It's like the action stuff I did like. I just wish that there was a little bit more variety, and I just wish that we had, you know, better character arcs. Yeah. I'm not asking for something huge. I'm not asking for it to be like a total drama. I'm just expecting, I'm comparing it to its peers in terms of action films. When you compare it to Kaiju films, like I said, it's a damn good Kaiju film. But as an action adventure film, I found, you know, the plot to be kind of mediocre.
It's no Godzilla Final Wars. Going back to the normal top five, we have 12 Years a Slave, which I recently saw a few days ago, and I think there's been a lot of conversation going on about this movie, whatever side you want to take, if it's good or bad. I mean, if you hate this film, you're really stretching yourself. This is a damn good movie.
If you hate this movie, you are trying to hate it. You're going out of your way to hate it. It's like 12 Years a Slave. It's, while it is not my favorite film of the year, I think that it's probably the best film. Like if I was like grading these films,
you're going to put this in a vault somewhere, pick the best film all around that needs to reach the most people.
Yeah. Like if I was grading films on all these things, like 12 Years a Slave would have like an A++++++. It's a remarkable film, not only for the subject matter that it handles, but it handles it just, it never feels preachy. It never feels like it takes one side too strongly. It presents these people as people in these situations. And that's what's so remarkable about it, is that you've had films about slavery and the subject in the past, but the problem is that it presents in a way that's either too, you know, heavy-fisted. Yeah. It's too operatic. It's too preachy. Or it goes too far on the other extreme where it just it tries, you know, too much to make genre out of it.
Exploitative. Something like Django Unchained, which I like.
I like too, but I see the reason why like people have a problem with that. But
it's funny because 12 Years a Slave, like we were talking about all the different reactions people, like some people feel it doesn't go far enough, which is crazy.
I don't see how that's possible.
And some people feel it's too cold and distant, which I completely disagree with.
No, the thing about this film that is what makes it, you know, so resounding is the fact that it has all these things. It has this kind of, you know, open and honest look at, you know, the time of life that it was and just like the way of life that it was for these people, and at the characters, and the fact that it's just like not everyone was perfect. And just like going to a Michael Fassbender's character, it'd have been so easy. He plays a slave owner. Yeah,
which many people I've seen accuse as like, oh, they were just a two-dimensional caricature.
It was not two-dimensional at all. This guy has some serious issues that he's trying to work through, and through Fassbender's performance, you do get more, because so many roles in this movie, it would be so easy to play.
Like, I'm an evil guy. I'm evil.
Paul Dano.
Yeah. Which we got to admit is the one, evil slave owner. Who, even Paul Dano's character, who is introduced pretty early on, so we can talk a little bit about him, that he is personally, his reaction is not just because, you know, he's not like, I hate black people, but because he is undermined in his job, which is why he reacts so vehemently against, I'm not even going to try to say the main actor's name.
Yes, which I feel absolutely terrible about. I've been trying to. The guy who plays Solomon, is just so fantastic. If he doesn't win some sort of Oscar, I don't know what this year is, but he is just so damn good, and he carries the movie that has just such gigantic weight to it, and he's able to sustain it for that entire time.
He's really good. He's always been good.
He has been good.
I recommend like Red Belt, the David Mamet film, and he's a villain in Serenity.
That's right. Yeah. I forgot about that. But I really hope that his career kind of takes off from
beyond here because villains.
Because he deserves to be, you know, like an A-lister. He is just that good in his role here.
Something I noticed watching the film is that Steve McQueen has gone from, you know, Hunger, which has a very distant and cold style, to, I haven't seen Shame.
I really enjoyed Shame, but it is a completely different film than 12
Years. And it almost feels like 12 Years a Slave. The way people originally talked, I thought that it was going to be a much more, I don't know, difficult watch, but maybe almost every shot in 12 Years a Slave could be separated and shown as like a piece of, you know, art in of itself.
Yeah,
it's so well composed and so cinematic in its presentation without undermining its subject matter.
Well, that's the thing is McQueen used to be...
Some people would say that's show-offy, yeah.
McQueen used to be, you know, kind of like he had history as, you know, as an
artist,
like,
yeah, installations.
You know, art installation projects and stuff like that. And I haven't seen Hunger, but for Shame, it does have a bit of that art house feel to it where it's not a traditional story. It deals more with themes. But the thing with 12 Years a Slave is that it just feels like such a giant leap for the filmmaker and films in that genre to begin with. Like, even if it wasn't a film about slavery, just like this film as a drama, like in terms of dramatic films, it's still just like it's absolutely fantastic the way that it handles everything and the characters and the pacing and the plot and the script. It's just... It's one of those films I'm just like, yeah, that's a perfect movie. It's just like you've done it.
Yeah, anchored by a Hans Zimmer cribbing James Horner style is his Inception score.
But it's once again it's kept to a minimum.
And it works within the context of the film. Yeah. It's not completely distracting.
Yeah.
Unlike Paul Giamatti showing up or Brad Pitt as the savior. Which is interesting because you could approach the film as Brad Pitt being such a big star and being the character who, you know, he does the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't want to get too many spoilers here.
Yeah. It's best to avoid spoilers because the thing you got to remember too, is that this is also
spoiler. He was a slave for 12 years.
Well, this is based on a real story. Yeah. Like this actually happened to the guy. And I think what's kind of so brilliant about it too, is the fact that, you know, it's heartbreaking enough to have a story where you just introduce a character who's already in slavery and to have that, but to have a character who is a free man and then be, you know, captured and then sold into slavery, it's just that thought alone of just the fact that you're free one day and you're not the next is terrifying to anyone, regardless of your background or your history. That's still just a terrifying concept, and this film just explores that just fantastically.
Going on to free men, let's move on to something that I've seen this on a lot of people's top 10 lists, but I've also seen it on people's worst film of all time. In the alternative section at number 3, we have Michael Bay's Pain and Gain. Now, I'm going to preface this with saying I am a Michael Bay fan. Do I hate Transformers 2? Yes. Do I find Transformers 1 really boring and I have no idea what's going on? Yes. But I do love The Rock. I do love the complete moral, emptiness of Bad Boys 2. I enjoy Armageddon.
You see, with Michael Bay's films, like, some of them I'm just kind of like, that was dumb, that was fun, like The Rock. I'm just like, you know what, I had fun with that, I will admit. But so many other ones, like, there are bits where I'm just like, yeah, that was a great action scene, or that was fun, but at the same time, just the movie itself, I'm just like, I can't like this. There's just something about it that just like
morally repugnant.
Yeah, just like something about this is repulsive to me.
Yeah.
But what works with Pain and Gain is the fact that he is taking on repulsive characters. Yeah. He is taking on these completely abhorrent characters, and he is telling their story, also another true story.
Yeah.
But like the trashiness works for this story, and it works so well that it's just I couldn't believe it either. This film out of my top 10 was like number 6.
Yeah,
it is just a good movie.
It brings up, I've heard people say that one thing that you can, if you walk into the film and you don't find it funny right away, like that's a big problem. And that when people like, I think it's very difficult to find people who are just middling on this movie and we're like, oh, it's okay. I think that you either like it or you hate it. And the question you also have to ask yourself, kind of like Spring Breakers, is how much in on the joke is Michael Bay on this kind of material? Because is he just adapting a really good script? Or because he shoots these characters like he shoots all of his other heroes.
Yeah.
Low angle, slow motion. So he's giving all this mystic stature to these pieces of shit because they view themselves that way.
To me, yeah, that's the thing. I see it as a representation of the characters, that this is the kind of, you know,
this is what they imagined their movie would be.
Yeah, like
they
would imagine they'd be in the fantasy that they're living in. That's how they view it. And this also was a passion project for Michael Bay.
It was that he, I think he, the deal was, I'll make Transformers 3 if I get to make Pain and Gain.
Yeah, and so like that was. That's what piqued my interest, first of all. It was just like, Michael Bay has a passion project.
He did want to make Pearl Harbor for his mother because he wanted to tell a love story.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's just something about Pain and Gain where that the things about Michael Bay films that I usually hate is just within this context and within these characters. Usually the notes that are just so loud and just, you know, and so annoying and grating that usually have Michael Bay films. Here, it works within the context of the story. I think these jokes, they work far better in a film that's an R-rated look at these, you know, psychopaths than it does in a PG-13 sort of family film where it's supposed to be like, this is normal life. This is the way it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where the problems kind of come from, films like Transformers and stuff like that. But here it actually, you know, it helps with the film itself. But something I want to say too is that, you don't give this man enough credit a lot of the times, but man, oh man, Mark Wahlberg in this role.
It's great.
He isn't like Boogie Nights level of just like,
but you know greatness. What? Mark Wahlberg has been on a pretty goddamn roll lately. Kind of like Channing Tatum. He was in Ted. He had the other guys like 3 or 4 years ago. Like he has gone from being like the dude in Antoine Fuqua's Shooter to like a level of respect cinematically and choosing interesting projects.
I think that Mark Wahlberg, he is just so great in Dirk Diggler mode, where he kind of plays characters that are a bit
confident but don't really know what's going on.
They're not the brightest, but they have these huge dreams and aspirations that they want to go for. But that's man, the combination of Mark Wahlberg and Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Okay, yeah. I have to say that I'm a huge Dwayne Johnson fan, and he kills it in this movie. Like I don't think he's ever been funnier in a film than he is in Pain and Gain.
It's he plays this like little boy that's trapped in this giant roided up man's body, and it is just note for note perfect. Yeah. It's just like he's walking around this like what little red baseball cap and skateboard.
Yeah,
like, it feels like he's just like, you know, he's busting into the kitchen. He's like, "Hey, mom, you like I want some milk and cookies." But it's just it's the contrast of like these characters of who they really are, and also, you know, kind of the dreams and just how absurd their dreams are. Yeah. It's what really makes it. This is what I like to call out of the American Dream kind of trilogy.
It's
kind of
like it would play this year, like Spring Breakers and Pain and Gain would be a perfect double bill. And Pain and Gain and Wolf of Wall Street kind of tell the same story of people wanting to take shortcuts too.
It's just kind of like how absurd, you know, what some ideas, like some people's ideas of, you know, their perfect life, their perfect reality would be, the dreams that they have, and just how, you know, what lengths that they go through to get those, when on the surface they're just such shallow, you know.
And you even, know, for example, in Pain and Gain, when they do get those dreams, they like run through their fingertips before it's over. Yeah. Like before they're able to like latch on and just live their life, it's gone. And they need to like struggle to get something else because it doesn't really mean anything.
And something else too that I will say about this is, as a film when I was watching it, I'm just like, okay, Michael Bay, that's a little bit too far over the top. I have to say this, the moments of the film that you think just like, no way.
Yeah.
Those are the real moments.
Yeah.
It's like, go and read the articles.
It's boring. It's like 10 times worse than the movie is. Like, they were real pieces of shit.
It's just the moments that you just think there's no way that any human could possibly do this. Like, these guys did it. Which is why I think, like, that Michael Bay's portrayal of the story and the characters is probably, any other director, it would have been censored, or it would have made them a little bit smarter, or made a little bit classier or more sympathetic. But here it just basically presents the story as it is, just like what these guys will go through for their own, you know, what they want out of life, which is just wealth and power and physical power.
Yeah.
It's just the idea that these weight, you know, these bodybuilder guys, just they literally want all things, you know.
It's
are symbols of power.
It's difficult to understand when people can, like, maybe Michael Bay did sympathize with these people, and some critics have said, like, how can you watch a movie that sympathizes? I never get that feeling through this film. It's almost like I'm not comparing it, but it's like Coen Brothers' sense of disconnect to these characters, kind of like Wolf of Wall Street.
Well, that's kind of how I felt when watching, not with Wolf of Wall Street, but with Coen Brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that kind of jumped into my mind was actually kind of Burn After Reading, just mm-hmm. kind of like these characters are not the brightest. They all have, you know, kind of terrible goals. They're in it for themselves, but there's something just so interesting about watching them play off of each other and just kind of seeing how they will screw up next.
And there's no doubt in my mind that Michael Bay does not want us to laugh with these characters. He wants us to laugh at them.
Yes.
Like, there's no... It, which is why it's kind of... That's what I think about Wolf of Wall Street, is when people think that they're... glamorized. They're not. Like, no. Especially Martin Scorsese obviously wants us to think about what they're doing and to laugh at them. That is where
he's replaced, you know, gangsters with Wall Street brokers.
Yeah, Scorsese has. So do you have high hopes for Transformers 4 then, starring Marky Mark?
Yeah, see, the thing is, no. I think, you know, Pain and Gain, if he continues to kind of try to make those weird...
But it's such like a magical, like...
I don't think he's ever going to top it. I don't think he's ever going to top it.
I think that it's such a magical, like, of diluted subject matter, which is the core of Michael Bay cinema, is mythologia... I can't say the word, but, you know, making all these things bigger and legendary when really they're not. And that's all about what his directorial style is. Like, low angles, tracking along... And really shiny.
Yeah, and it's just, once again, the contrast between just kind of, you know, how low and scuzzy these characters are, but mm-hmm. presented in, like, as action heroes, it's just, that combination is just perfect. That's what kind of just sets the whole tone of the movie.
And speaking of Coen Brothers, we have a film on our top five list that is going to be a surprise to no one. As we get closer and closer to the end, this is when all the films, it's like, you know, our top five is 12 Years a Slave. Well, yeah, no fucking duh, it's 12 Years a Slave. That's on every top five list ever. And that's Inside Llewyn Davis, yes. which I saw a few days ago and absolutely loved, and Pierce had seen like a week ago and loved it as well. I think that this is a film that could easily have its own podcast dedicated to it because there's so much to talk about.
It's so dense and just all the stuff that it goes through. It's one of these films where if you describe the plot to someone, you're just like, oh, it's just kind of a guy that goes out and does some stuff.
Yeah.
But it's what the Coens do here is the way that they present it and just like the themes that they inject into every scene. Is that every scene, it feels like it's kind of its own story. It could be its own movie. It could mm-hmm. be it's like every scene, it feels like it has some sort of arc to it, which is, you know, something that makes me think back to, I don't know. It's kind of like, you know, the stuff with, like Boogie Nights, where you can almost just kind of separate any of those scenes and show them on its own.
Something interesting that, I saw while I was watching it. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but, it's kind of like, Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye, in the sense that the Elliot Gould character is going around, all these stories are happening around him, mm-hmm. and like the Oscar Isaacs character in Inside Llewyn Davis, like all these stories going around Oscar Isaacs are probably much more interesting than what's happening to him. But because he's threading through all these, like, you know, stories and going on his own way and trying to discover his own thing, and I'm not going to make this a spoiler to anyone, but there's no big dramatic reveal at the end of the film. Or anything like that.
Well, that's what I think makes it so like poignant, is the fact that if it did have some sort of big like revelation at the end, or some sort of big mm-hmm. thing that happens where like this character gets together with this character, or this character's problems are magically solved, it would just kind of make the impact of the film, you know, it would lessen that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the kind of the themes that it explores and kind of the lessons that it has. It really is a film where it's just kind of, you can go back and just kind of keep digging into the mythology mm-hmm. of, you know, the way that he presents this world that surrounds this screw up character.
And there's so many ways to interpret this film. I read someone said, like, you could picture the film through the prism of, because the story is about a character who has to deal with principally someone he was very close to dying, who committed suicide. I read someone said, what if this is a movie about what would happen if one of the Coen brothers died and the other one had to go on? And that's how he viewed his life. There's so many ways you can read this film and break up scenes and subtextually, even though the Coen brothers will probably make fun of you for doing that.
Yeah. Well, we were having a discussion on New Year's as well. I don't want to go too much into it because of a spoiler territory, but the fact is that, you know, there were three of us discussing it, and we all had different interpretations of, like, one scene in particular. And it's just, I think that it, you know, it takes a certain level of filmmaking to accomplish it, where everyone can have their own interpretations of a scene, but none of them feel like, oh, you're completely wrong. Yeah. All of them have their own merit and based upon what you take out of it. And it's just, oh man, Oscar Isaac as well.
And he's a great musician. I think something really important, and something that's about the folk music scene, is that the music is very good and the people who are performing it do it very well, especially Oscar Isaac. When the Coen brothers like to film a lot of things and just, they let all the music play. Mm-hmm. Like when someone sings a song, usually you hear that entire song. So it's very important that what you're hearing isn't shitty or even just average, because of the story that the film is telling about a character who can't break through, like, talented. Another way to read this film is, this is the film of what would have happened if the Coen brothers hadn't been successful. Because you can interpret this through the artistic prism of being a writer, an actor, a filmmaker, you know, a sculptor. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't even have to be about someone who's an artist. It can just be about anyone who has any sort of aspirations for life.
That
struggle of just where things are not going the way that you want them, mm-hmm. and finding some way to kind of work through that and work through your own life and just kind of accepting things, but also knowing when, you know, accepting things for as they are is not good enough, when you should try to push yourself mm-hmm. to kind of do the things that you actually want to do.
And how to deal with those things when you fail.
Yeah.
Because
it handles so much, but I love the way that it, you know, it treats it with this kind of, you know, mythological kind of storytelling mm-hmm. that the Coens obviously have loved to.
Yeah.
To toss into their cinema. But it's just something about that contrast, the acting, since he runs into all these characters, you get all these great supporting roles mm-hmm. from so many talented actors that steal the scene when they show up, but they never steal the movie,
mm-hmm.
which is also something that's hard to do. So I think it's got so many great themes going on with it. It's got so many great scenes, so many great performances.
Go see Inside Llewyn Davis. Yeah. Pretty much what we're trying to say, as we spray praise all over it with our bodily fluids.
The thing about this film too is that we're not just guys that are just like, oh yeah, like, oh, this film was so, you know, artistic and mm-hmm. great. Like what's the stuff that you usually watch, Justin?
What, me?
Yeah.
I watch all types of things, but I like to watch action films and horror and Italian and 70s exploitation. And
yeah, so like we're not guys that are just like only, you know, dramas or only action movies or something.
Arty
like that.
Farty.
Yeah, it's like, there are tons of arty farty movies out there where it's just like, yeah, it's arty, but at the same time, yeah, it still is farty.
I think the important thing is that Inside Llewyn Davis, for all of its talk that we've had of that it's open-ended and stuff like that, is that it's also compelling.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably the most important thing with these kind of films.
Yeah.
To the point that one of my girlfriend's friends said, I want to watch all the Coen brothers' filmography after seeing Inside Llewyn Davis. And I don't think there can be any more of a hearty response than that when watching, you know, an artist's film, saying, I want to see the other films this person has made.
Yeah, it's the fact too that these guys have been around for how long?
Ooh, since the 80s when they made Blood Simple.
Yeah, they're still making stuff that people are discovering and becoming fans of, where they're just like I want to know. Because I can easily see this being a movie where someone goes like, I want to know more about cinema. I want to know more about movies. I want to kind of dig more into this stuff. And it's just, you know, it's a great combination of everything, of film, of music, of just storytelling.
Yeah. Go see it again. Oh well, there's a patented laser blast laugh that I usually have when I'm with a group of people. I'm trying to eliminate that. Moving on, we can go back to the alternative top five. Speaking of arty farty films, we have Upstream Color, Shane Carruth's second film, the director of Primer. This is a film that, surprisingly, I didn't rush out to see when it played in cinemas at the TIFF Lightbox. When I heard about it, I think that because of the reason I didn't rush out to see it, even though I love Primer a lot, is just how abstract all of the reviews were and the synopsis, so it didn't really drag me into it too much. So, and you actually saw it in theaters months ago.
No, I did not see it in theaters. I had the kind of, I would say, almost, you know, perfect viewing situation of watching this movie at about like 3:30 a.m. one night when I was, you know, kind of exhausted. It has a certain dreamlike quality to it that is It's stunning, yet it's also kind of subdued at the same time. It's very hard to describe.
An interesting comparison is it almost has the rhythms of something like Spring Breakers, which is like the montage-y storytelling.
Repeating thematic elements.
Yeah. Upstream Color, as much as what I had read on the internet would lead me to believe that it'd be incredibly complicated, I think is a much simpler film than Primer. And I think that emotionally and linearly, it's easier to follow.
It has a definite story to it. It has a definite theme to
Beginning, middle, and ending.
It's just, unlike a lot of movies, it doesn't just go out and blatantly say, this is the message, this is the theme. It is a movie where if you're, don't watch this movie if you're, like, going to be, you know, like...
I want to laze around and just watch a movie, you know, decompress from the day.
Yeah, it's not a movie to watch if you're just, like, you know, on your computer at the time or, like, you're trying to make dinner. This is a film that you need to just... I always recommend that you sit down and actually kind of watch movies, but this is a movie where if you just kind of skip out on a couple scenes, you will have a hard time just kind of following it.
But other than that, it is a film that, you know, you can follow. So that's probably the first recommendation I would say to people who want to watch Upstream Color. But at the same time, a lot of it is very obtuse. And that there'll be things that you're like, I don't quite understand what this has to do with everything else. But I think that's why it'll be something interesting to revisit and to discover.
Well, also, even those bits, if you don't quite understand, there's just something about the cinematography and the editing that every image kind of evokes a feeling and helps establish the mood of the piece and helps create this kind of, you know, strange atmosphere and environment that the characters are experiencing. So while not everything is like literal text in the movie, it's filled with just such wonderful subtext
and symbolism.
Yeah. And also like, this is a very small, low.
I was about to say that something else that's very interesting about it is that Shane Carruth, I'm probably saying his name wrong.
Carruth, I think.
It's a real shame that did he make it too difficult for himself? Like, this is a conversation I would like to have with him or someone that knows him, is that after Primer, it kind of felt like he could take over the world and he could, you know, at least a studio would give him a shot. Mm-hmm. I know he wrote a film called A Topiary, which I haven't read the screenplay. It's like 250 pages long. It's out there. And it's another very abstract, high concept. And I think that, I don't know if he just kind of like tried to pursue that and it never happened, but Upstream Color is a result of him pretty much doing it all himself. He distributed it himself too.
He was also the cinematographer. The film was shot on these $700 DSLRs.
That he modified.
Yeah.
And he was a composer and he's a lead actor and he's the editor, so.
Yeah, it's just kind of remarkable to see, you know, usually, you know, like these kind of, you know, art films are more, usually do have a, like, they are usually smaller crews and smaller productions, but it is astonishing to see, you know, kind of, you know, this one guy's vision just kind of pumped out there when he's, and it's not a thing where it's a lot of these things you see just like, oh yeah, maybe that guy shouldn't have tried to put on so many hats in production. Like, this part's not so great, but all these things. Like, I had no idea he was the main guy actor when I was watching the film. I had no idea that he did the music.
It doesn't feel that way.
Cinematography. Yeah. It feels like they had people that were all damn good at their jobs doing their respective roles. And so it's just the fact that he was able to pull all that off with the help of his, you know, fellow filmmakers on the project. It just speaks volumes about his work as a
filmmaker. I really hope that he gets the opportunity to go out and make those movies that he wants to make. Even, what's the name of the company that funded the American Hustle? And it's that one woman.
Oh, yeah.
She needs to give Shane some money.
Yeah, so. I know who you're talking about.
I don't remember the exact. I think her name is Megan something.
Isn't that the same one that gave, like, funded some of the Coens stuff?
She funded True Grit American Hustle, and she brought all these independent films, or, like, these, you know, specific filmmakers and their specific vision to cinemas. And that's great, because a lot of those films, like True Grit, was a huge success. So, you know, and American Hustle has been successful critically, and I'm not sure about commercially that much, but...
I think it's doing okay for itself. It's not like breaking any box office records.
But it's hopefully it makes its money back so these experiments can continue. And I mean, if Shane Carruth wants to continue making these independent films, I hope he does, but I hope it doesn't take another 10 years.
Yeah.
Like Primer did.
And I agree.
If you haven't seen Primer, go and see it, because that's another film that's begging to be watched if you haven't. We still have two other movies to go in both lists, but before that, let's be a little bit more negative again and go to our disappointments of 2013. Now, these two are not that much shocking, like, we wanted to like them. While we were talking about it, we found it really difficult to find films that we were really disappointed in. But me and Pierce did go see Great Gatsby together. And I have to preface this with saying that, like, it's a Baz Luhrmann film. You know, I had a pretty good idea of what I was getting into.
I did too. The thing is that, like, I've liked Baz Luhrmann stuff.
I know. I like Strictly Ballroom. I like Moulin Rouge. And I like, I don't know if I find it too compelling, but maybe I had to be there when it came out, Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. I was really looking forward to his take on the subject because the cast is great. Like, you've got, like, since we're jumping from before, not too long ago, we're discussing Inside Llewyn Davis, but also Kerry Mulligan's in this film. Kerry Mulligan. You got Leonardo DiCaprio. You've got Joel Egerton.
Yeah, I really like Joel Egerton.
Yeah, so you got like this fantastic cast and like one of the, you know, like most historically significant novels of.
But the problem with this is, you know, at the base is that this novel is not adaptable to cinema.
I'm going to go into a little bit of rant here.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I have talked to some people that are huge fans of the book and just like, oh yeah, I love like hearing, you know, like these lines were from the book and how like true it was to the book. But the problem is, I think that first of all, if someone tells you like, oh, you should read the book first to enjoy the movie, if
anyone that's crazy,
that's bullshit.
Yeah.
If you're supposed
Southland
to read,
Tales.
If you're supposed to read the book before you watch the movie, the book better come with your fucking ticket. But it's an adaptation. Yeah. It doesn't have to be note per note per note. It's an adaptation. You're taking a story, you're taking a subject, and you're adapting it to work into the film format. You're making it work as a movie. My problem with The Great Gatsby is that you've got a lot of these great themes. You've got a lot of these great concepts. You've got a ton of like great cinematography of these elaborate numbers. But the problem is that in between all those is that it's just kind of a boring movie.
It is a boring movie. And I think that's because like we were talking about Inside Llewyn Davis, which is compelling, is that Great Gatsby is pretty much dramatically inept. And I think that it's at once it feels almost like, I haven't read The Great Gatsby since high school. But I remember that its dramatic structure is very difficult to adapt in cinematic form. And the movies, and it's been adapted a number of times, they've mm-hmm. never worked. Like, there's never one movie where you go...
Well, that's why I was hoping that Baz Luhrmann, he would have enough sense to be like, you know what, let's go in, let's
I'm going to change the ending. Gatsby's going to live, and he's going to turn around and shoot the bad guys.
The ending, you know, is kind of the whole point of the story. But I meant in the fact of taking some of those middle pieces that are not that important and rejigging them into, you know, something that does work in a cinematic fashion.
So you would say that you would have to pull a Peter Jackson from the original Lord of the Rings in his adaptation of switching things and rewriting to make them work cinematically?
Yeah, just like, as long as
I mean, many Tolkien purists will disagree with us.
But as long as you're pure to the concept of the story and the characters, it's your movie. Do whatever you want with it. Do whatever you want with it to have to make it work. The reason you're not going in and you're filming the book, you're filming a script. Yeah. The script is there for a reason to make the, you know, adjustments necessary.
So basically what you're saying is that the great Gatsby had to be rich, hollow, and at the end he dies. As long as those elements were in your Great Gatsby and you can fill in the other stuff for the middle.
Saying, like, as long as Gatsby created this, you know, this reinvention of himself, and he did it for all these reasons, and as long as he has that fall at the end when he realizes that, okay, these are not, you know, the best reasons for doing this, like, then
you have the movie.
Yeah, then like that is the movie.
Yeah,
you don't need, you know, a line per line scene that's from like page, you know, like
176
or whatever. You don't need to have all those elements to be the same movie. Take a few key lines, throw those in, but make it work. Because just like Tobey Maguire is wasted in this film, in my thoughts personally. Leonardo DiCaprio, he does a great job.
I think Carrie Mulligan is wasted.
And she's also wasted. Because the problem is that they take these characters and they keep them so true to the book, but they don't bother to try to make things...
Any chemistry or anything like that, or a reason to care.
Yeah, it's so it honestly feels that just like what you see is just a visual representation of the book, but that doesn't necessarily make a movie.
At the same time, I would say that Baz Luhrmann, beyond the adaptations, I felt that at some points in the film, he was bombastic when he should have been calm, and calm when he should have been bombastic.
Exactly. It felt like what really spoke to him when he was like, just like, oh man, Great Gatsby, I can make this as a movie, were the party sequences. Mm-hmm. It was just like, oh man, I'm going to make all these awesome, you know, like 1920s sequences.
That's fine.
But the problem is in that in between those, you've got like 40 minutes of story,
mm-hmm.
and it's just... It doesn't seem like he's that interested in telling those pieces as he is.
I would say that probably the biggest representation of the failures of this film is, this is not a spoiler, like I hope the people listening to this know the story of The Great mm-hmm. Gatsby, is when Leonardo DiCaprio as Gatsby dies. In that, in the film, it's played in the most over-dramatic, slow-motion fashion, which makes no connection at all with the viewer because you're so disconnected from the style on screen that it's difficult to, you know, generate any kind of emotion.
I will say this. There was one good sequence, one really sequence that kind of sticks my mind dramatically, was the Joel Egerton sequence when they're in the, was it like hotel room?
The hotel room with the ice.
Yeah, the heat. That scene is fantastic. But the rest of the movie, it either feels like it's not, like it's, you know, it's underhanded or it's too heavy-handed. Yeah, yeah. It's too over the top. It's not loud enough. It just struggles to find that balance. Some scenes he does hit it, but as a whole,
it's rare.
Yeah.
I think that it's a good comparison piece is Moulin Rouge. That does work dramatically mm-hmm. when it's like big and like all over the place. And like Moulin Rouge is a mess of a film. I'll be the first one to admit that. But overall, it works. And The Great Gatsby doesn't, which is a big bummer. Now, I haven't seen Australia, but I'm curious to see how that, like, that was, you know, Baz Luhrmann's last film. That was met with very shaky responses. But, you know, I don't know if he's getting out of his depth or...
Yeah, I don't know what's happening to him, but I hope this is kind of...
Like a speed bump.
Yeah, I hope that this is kind of just like he refines his legs after this. Yeah. And just like he makes something that is truly a great, you know, a combination of his style and just kind of his storytelling, where you can still get behind these characters in these grandiose sort of tales.
Now, as far as disappointment goes, our last one is not really a disappointment because, I mean, other than me, no one in our group was looking forward to it. And I should say that we saw this movie after seeing White House Down, we saw White House Down and we were on such a high.
We were so pumped. We were so just like, oh man, that movie was so fun. It was so like, dumb, but so fun.
We should see another movie. And Pierce was even like, I'll get your ticket, Justin. And like, let's go see The Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a Gore Verbinski fan. I like Mouse Hunt. I like Pirates of the Caribbean. I haven't seen The Mexican since I was like 12, so I can't really speak of that. But I even enjoyed parts of the Caribbean 2 and 3. I mean, Gore Verbinski was completely out of his depths, but there was obviously vision and intent there. And the thing that interested me the most about The Lone Ranger is that it was a passion project. Because it made a lot of, you know, the variety and stuff like that, in that they gave a script, the studio turned it down, Johnny Depp, Jerry Bruckheimer, Verbinski, they all said, oh, we'll drop our fees, you're like, we want to make this movie.
How expensive was this movie?
It was like $250 million.
It was an absurd amount, an amount that like no movie should cost.
And let us say that like we are not ones to say like... Like, remember when John Carter came out? I don't know if you've seen it.
I hadn't seen it.
I've seen it. And it's fun. It has a lot of problems. But people were all like, it cost $300 million. How could something cost like $300 million? But, you know, you can understand with something like that. Big alien vistas. They're, you know, figuring stuff out. CG characters. Nothing should cost, in my personal opinion, like over $150 million.
Yeah, even
that. That's ridiculous. I mean, but like Avengers cost like $200 million. But that's because you get into star salaries.
Yeah, you get into star salaries, and also you're basically employing an entire effects house to do mm-hmm. all your computer animation and stuff like that.
So I love I love Westerns. I like Arnie Hammer.
Here's something else, too. I am a fan of the original Lone Ranger, like the original Lone Ranger serials and stuff like that. Those are some of my earliest memories as a child, like watching movies. It's like I remember reenacting like scenes from like the kind of the first Lone Ranger serial. It's like a character that I actually did like and did enjoy. So it wasn't just like, I don't like Westerns. I don't like the Lone Ranger.
Like I'm tired of Johnny Depp's shtick. None of this entered our critical, like, we went in to this empty theater, I think, yes. at like 7 o'clock.
And this was like,
it was
the
a
first,
giant theater.
This was, here's the thing, this is on like a cheap day. Yeah. And it was like only basically like the week that the film had yeah. opened. And it's on Tuesday, it's usually the theater is packed. You're having to fight for seats because everyone's like, you get a discount. So yeah. everyone goes that day. But we went in. And it was four of us. We went into the theater and just like there was no one else there.
And so I was excited. You know, Gore Verbinski's kind of Terry Gilliam-ish in a Western. It cost an obscene amount of money, which means it must be all up on screen. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Do you have something else
no,
to say
I was just,
before?
Just before we go totally into it, like I expected it to be, I had heard the reviews.
Middling
like,
reviews.
Where it's just like, it's not very good. And I went in with that mindset, but even with that mindset,
this movie made me angry. Like, I rarely get angry at films, but this is one of those rare films that I can watch and go, there is nothing redeeming in this film. Everyone that made this film seems like they fucking hate the Lone Ranger. The film ends.
He is such a dick.
The film ends with him going, "Hi-ho, Silver," and then Tonto going, "Never do that again." It's like it should just ended with them like whizzing on the audience, like onto the camera.
The thing while I was watching this movie is like at first, you know,
we were in for it yeah. for the first 15 minutes.
The first 15 minutes, it does have some really fun action stuff. And like, it's just like, oh yeah, this is going to be like a really fun, you know, thrill ride. But then we get into the actual characters and just like what it's exploring. And I'm just like, everything about this film feels so misguided where they should have gone left, they went 100 miles right.
Mm-hmm.
And just watching that as a viewer, like the first half hour or so, it was frustrating enough. But by the time you get to like the hour and a half point, you're just kind of, there's
this
a part of you,
a 2 hour
livid.
Movie.
There's a part of you that's like livid. Just like, how can they just keep taking every wrong
this is
step?
A $250 million film that has two action scenes that both take place on trains.
Yes.
I'm at a loss for words, and I spoke many words after coming out of this movie, because there's many, it's just bad. It's bad, bad, bad. It's they're not even trying. That's like, it doesn't feel like they are. And that's the most insulting part.
Like, the Lone Ranger has no arc in the film. He's just...
He's a jerk.
He's a jerk. He's a selfish jerk for 90% of the movie, but then near the end...
He magically gets shooting skills.
He magically... Because he's just like this wimpy guy that has no skills. His brother's a real hero, but then his brother dies, and then he's kind of, you know, left to run around and avenge him and fill his brother's shoes as being this great person. But the problem is that he never becomes this great person. You never see him learn from his mistakes, or learn from being a jackass, or change or grow as a person. He's just an asshole. And then the next scene, he's on Silver.
Magically doing trick shots.
Magically doing trick shots and saving the day. And it just feels like you're watching a completely different movie. Like you just, you skip like 2 years of this character's life. Just like, how is he this person now? Why is any of this happening? And the tonal shift from that final climax. Before this film, there are so many just absurd moments. Just like, is this a kid's movie? Is this a family movie?
You know what? I would back up those moments if there was more fun attached to them. Like, I was talking about Kids in Peril a second ago, and that I love family movies that are violent or, like, dangerous. But this one has, like, a dude eating another one's heart, and a horse dying, and then, like, it's played for laughs.
And just, like...
It's just not funny. I think that's the biggest problem.
That's the problem, is that it just all feels so misguided. It's just like, this scene does not work. Yeah. It just does not work in this context. And there are just so many scenes that are just like, why are they here? Lone Ranger kills two dudes accidentally. But still, it's just like there's...
He like crushes their heads.
Yeah, it's just like, hey kids, Lone Ranger, you know, like the guy of all who's good, and then just like he's crushing heads, and they're kicking. There really is, you know, a kicking a dead horse gag.
Yeah. What if this is like we've heard some defenders, Kurt, who said that this is the deconstruction of these kind of movies, and that's a big like joke on the studios.
But
do you think this will be like a Hudson Hawk? That people will... You know, you still haven't seen Hudson Hawk, have
no,
you?
No, but I know the gist of Hudson... But the problem is that if this was a deconstruction, is that it doesn't really deconstruct it that well, because even if it was a deconstruction
or satire,
or yeah, you take out all the fact that like there's not much fun in it. If you just had those scenes, the problem is that those scenes themselves on their own are still not good.
Yeah,
the film's pacing, the way that it jumps around, it's just not good. You can have, you know, the lessons of...
I forgot the Lone Ranger killed two guys.
Yeah. Like...
Brutally.
Like, I can get, you know, if they wanted to make a commentary of just like, yeah, like they didn't learn their lesson. They treated Native Americans horribly.
Oh, we forgot the whole Native American massacre that happens.
Yeah. What? Yeah, here's the thing, too. When this entire just like, you know, annihilation of this entire tribe is happening...
There's goofy
slapstick comedy happening with like Tonto and the Lone Ranger on a train track, you know, one of those push up and down carts, and it's slapstick comedy happening while so much mass carnage is falling around them. And the thing is, like, if the rest of the tone of the movie had been different, and like if there was, you know, that kind of sense, like there was an actual kind of message thrown to here. But the problem is that it's just every scene felt so disconnected from the last, and it's
boring.
Yeah, it's boring too. So when you factor all these things in, that you have this gigantic Western, like $250 million movie.
Nothing happens. The lead is horrible.
Nothing happens. The characters are not endearing. It's most of the time it's just kind of offensive. And you've got all this stuff, and then you throw it together at the end with just like this one happy action scene where it just feels so completely far out there. Is that like, yeah, I can see if you take those subjects and maybe you present them in a different fashion, it could be, you know, this great kind of commentary and satire on Western and like the, you know,
deconstruction
and plus the Americans just kind of reinterpretation of it, how they took all these horrible events and made them into something fun. But it's just, I don't think that's what's going on here, because it doesn't meld together in any sort of shape, form, or fashion.
And you know what? If you want that, there's dozens of films that do that much better. So
just
go watch those movies.
Or like Blazing Saddles does that.
Unforgiven deconstructs the Western in an interesting way. Like,
yeah, it's just the fact that if you're
going to... Give me a fucking fun Lone Ranger movie.
Either give me like a fun Lone Ranger movie, or if you're going to do like this like super in-depth deconstruction of a movie, at least have it be entertaining while you're deconstructing.
Please. We did on purpose not to make it compelling.
Like, I don't even mean fun, but yeah, okay. Just compelling. Something where you're just watching it gives you a reason to keep watching it. Just watching this, like, I felt no reason to keep watching.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, that's always a shame when I'm at a movie and I feel like there's no need to.
Thank God we saw White House Down before.
Yeah.
But we should have seen Lone Ranger first.
Yeah.
Back on our top five list. Whew, man, that negative rant. We got to get back into the positive. We have your favorite film of the year, which was Spike Jonze's Her.
Yes.
And I'll just leave the floor to you on why do you think, what connected with you in this film and made it important for you?
Well, it's just, I don't know if it's just like the time of my life that I saw this film, or just like my own personal stuff, or just what that had to do with it, but there was just something about Her that was so unexpected. There's just kind of such a joyous combination of elements that it was my biggest surprise of the year. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a film that I also didn't see any trailers for this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear anything about it, except that I was just like, you know, it's kind of a one man show for Joaquin Phoenix who falls in love with an operating system.
I hope that nobody is going to be like listening, because we haven't really like given any plot for these movies that we're talking about.
Well, most of these are so big that you've probably heard the gist.
But yeah, like Joaquin Phoenix falls in love with an operating system played by Scarlett Johansson. That's the plot of Her.
Yeah,
in a nutshell.
That's the plot of that is the plot of Her. It doesn't really get more complicated than that. But the thing about this film that struck me, first off, I want to say is that you hear it, you think that, yeah, this is just going to be kind of, you know, one of these like heartbreaking, sad, you know, romantic films. But the thing about Her is that it's surprisingly really, really funny. It mm-hmm. has some great scenes of contrast where it's just like laugh out loud, hysterical stuff that is tossed into the mix. And I was not expecting a film to be able to kind of, you know, juggle all these kind of emotions in it so easily and not have the transition from one scene to the other feel awkward or misguided or out of place. It kind of naturally
feels real. Yeah, like that's the most important thing.
The reason why I love the film so much is that it's, in my opinion, kind of one of the best representations of a romance that I've seen in cinema. But what makes it more staggering is the fact that it's between one guy and a talking voice.
I think that that may be one of the reasons that, other than the structural steps it takes as a romance, is that it's boiled down to the most important parts. It's just two people.
It boils talking down to themselves. To two people talking and mm-hmm. and learning about themselves and through each other through conversations. And the thing about this movie too is that it doesn't take the concept of just wouldn't it be quirky and weird if a guy fell in love with his computer? The thing about it is that it's a real relationship. It doesn't just kind of stick with easy it would be just to kind of this computer is yours and yours alone. Of course, there's no challenge to it, but it goes through all these steps of a relationship, and there's just something so heartbreaking and real about it. But it's just, it's got such a great message about just, of human relationships, mm-hmm. but also kind of the way that technology has changed our relationships with ourselves and each other, the way that we communicate with each other, the way that we fall in love with each other.
Without ever being in an overbearing or, doom-inducing, it would have been very easy for this film to say, humanity doesn't connect anymore because they listen. They're on all these technological things when really...
No, but it tells you that, there are positives and mm-hmm. negatives to all these things, that, technology is a great way of connecting with each other. Mm-hmm. But you also have the danger of cutting yourself off from real people mm-hmm. by doing so. And it's just the way that it's so effortlessly, it captures these themes and these emotions. And a film just it's such a difficult performance to be able to have. Because for most of the movie, it is basically just, a guy on a phone.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And so huge, huge respect to Scarlett Johansson and Joaquin Phoenix. For Joaquin Phoenix to be able to emote with his face and to tell this side of it. And for Scarlett Johansson to convey that side just through her voice alone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just spectacular performances. Also great supporting cast with Amy Adams and all the great
Chris cameras. Pratt.
Yeah, Chris Pratt, who's blowing up.
Yeah, ooh, Guardians of the Galaxy. Here we go.
So it's just every...
And let's not forget, there's something that I think a lot of people miss when they talk about her, is the visual uniformity that Spike Jonze brings to the world. He actually shot in Shanghai for L.A., which gives that otherworldly, colored lights.
It's kind of the not-so-distant future where it's... Because that's the thing, you could easily set this where it's too far off in the future.
Or you could even set it in the present.
Yeah, you could set it in the present, but there's just something about it where it's just slightly in the future that it gives it kind of a romantic, slightly surreal quality to it. But at the same time, it never feels too over the top. So it's just everything about it, the tone, the performances, the story, the writing, the score, great score from Arcade Fire.
Mm.
It's just like... I adore this movie. Just every single frame of it feels perfect to me.
I love how, as we've gotten higher up in the top five, we've just ended every film summary with this is good, this is good, this is good, this is good. Just go and see the movie.
That's the thing. I honestly have nothing negative to say about the film. It's just, that's what I was talking about before. The reason why a lot of these films keep popping up on list is not because it's been a bad year for movies, but it's just that
They've been so good.
There have been a lot of great movies, but there are just some movies that are just so damn good that they rise above the others.
Like Pain and Gain.
Yeah.
I hope people that are just, listening to Laser Blast for the first time, I don't know how you discovered us, but go to our Facebook page, Laser Blast Film Society, or send me a message at laserblastfilmsociety@gmail.com and give your own opinion. Disagree with us.
If you disagree, if you think Her is a terrible movie, say why. Say the reason why you didn't like it. Tell us why, the problems that you have with it.
Because the only way that we can, continue to talk about film and discover new things is by talking about film. even though that the internet is not always the most forgiving place when it comes to discussion.
Or constructive criticism.
It's Matthew Kumar.
We love you, Matthew.
And finally, we go to our... I didn't have that much stuff to say about her because I know Pierce would be able to formulate my thoughts pretty much the same.
Is there anything else that you want to add to that?
No, that's pretty much it, because I think that, as I said again, when we get to the top, like, these films are so... they encapsulate all their ideas so easily that it's not like I don't need to dig very deep for, like, oh, well, this subtextual message spoke to me or this. Like, there's so much to talk about her also, like the fact of Joaquin Phoenix's job is about, you know, creating these emotional messages that are supposed to be handwritten for other people because he works as a letter writer, emotional letters. And there's a lot of stuff to deconstruct that we can't really do on this particular podcast. Perhaps we shall do it on another podcast. But not this one, because we still have one movie to go to, which has the emotional resonance of her also. And speaking of Matthew Kumar, who said that leaving this film that we're about to speak of, he said, I think I've seen the perfect film. And that film is called Iga. 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 If you haven't heard about it, just pause this and go look online, watch the trailer.
It's E-E-G-A.
And I think there's an H. Not to be confused with Iga, the movie with the giant monster. With
no.
The washed up...
This is a movie about a fly.
A fly. A man gets murdered, is reincarnated as a fly, and vows vengeance upon his murderer while falling back in love with the woman that, you know, his love originally got him killed as. Now, this sounds dumb. Like, if you explain it to someone, it seems like there's, like, a cultural distance to it.
It sounds absurd when you just...
Yeah. I mean, like, it's going to be, like, goofy. Like, does Eddie Murphy play the fly?
Well, it's also, like, it's kind of... It's not quite Bollywood, but, like, what
it's
is
Tollywood.
It? It's Tollywood, yes.
Yeah.
So it's got some musical numbers in it. Not that many, but it is that... It definitely has a bit of that cultural difference to the film.
Mm-hmm.
So when you combine those factors of the fact that it's about a guy that gets killed and comes back as a fly who seeks vengeance on a man... And you've got, like, these Tollywood musical numbers in it. It sounds very abstract and absurd to most people when you're pitching it.
But speaking of Lone Ranger, in comparison, Iga just really works well.
It does. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, I had to listen to Justin.
And our friend Peter.
Yeah. Like, you guys are just like, oh my god, Iga is just so amazing. You have to see this movie. It is so good. It's like one of the best movies you'll see all year.
And you were like, pfft.
And I was whatever. Just like, whatever, guys. Just like, stop overhyping it. Like, you're overselling it. You're overselling it. Then I went to see it. I saw a screen of it at Toronto After Dark. And just like, it's a good movie. I could not believe it as I was watching it. But like, this is a good movie.
Yeah. About a fly that like a guy, and it's ridiculous. It has its humor and it has all of the silliness that is inherent in the concept,
but it's also got heart, which is something that is super important when you're trying to tell a story where you have to kind of care about what happens to this character. You have to want this fly to succeed in his mission. I know how silly that sounds, but you have to want this fly to actually, you know, like win at the end of the day. And it's,
They
do it. They make
and it
care.
Escalates it, and they figure out interesting ways for the fly to interact with the villain and get above him without feeling, too much repetition or, you know, feeling too easy.
It's a film that can continually, like, evolves and adapts to the story that it's set up.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just, like playing it until it's just, like, always a fly just going to buzz around his face for, like, an entire movie, it just constantly escalates that concept of just, like, oh, what if I tried this? Yeah. What if I tried this?
And most
this?
Importantly, it doesn't talk.
Yeah.
Which is something that I was afraid of, except for, and I got to add, when Pierce saw it at Toronto After Dark, he actually saw the international version, which is supposed to be made for, you know, North American audiences, that cuts out of some of the I can't say that word.
Idiosyncratic.
Yeah, we were mumbling it.
Idiocentric
things. You need to go out and get the original Tollywood cut, because while it does have a long beginning, and it was one of the things that deterred me the first time I watched it, I was like, this movie's boring. The first 30 minutes is all song and dance, and it wasn't really my thing. But it adds in all these, like, crazy things, including a fly musical number in the end credits where the fly sings. which was cut out of the North American release. And there's also a big supernatural subplot that's cut out of the North American release. And the ending, like the final shot, which is really important. Mm-hmm. So if you want to see Iga, and I mean, unless you hate movies, why would you not want to see Iga? Make sure you get the original cut, not the international version, because the international version is condensed.
The international version, like, even though that's the one I saw, it's still not bad. Like, yeah. Basically with this movie, just kind of see it any way that you can.
Yeah.
Like, if you only can find the international, that's fine. If you can only find the Tollywood cut, that's fine.
Yeah.
But it
the Tollywood cut is superior.
If it's just a movie that you need to see for the ideas yeah. that it has and the way that it executes them. Because I'd never thought, like, seeing a movie that I would be rooting for a fly to take down, like, this evil guy. Or to be, like, going, like, oh, that's sweet, and, like, a romantic dinner between a fly and an adult woman. Like, it's just... It's those just kind of absurd moments, but like they work.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this film so special, is that it's able to take this level of absurdity and kind of condense it down to a human level where it's relatable and you can get behind it and you can root for it and just like enjoy the film without just being just like, oh, this is too stupid. Like it never feels like
the film was so popular that people made t-shirts like days later that they walked around the Toronto After Dark Film Festival wearing. And on that note, that's all the movies that we have to talk about. What are you, not the movie you're looking forward to most in 2014, but what is like the general like thing that you're looking forward to most? Do you think it's going to be a good year?
I'm looking forward to 2014. Like there's the start of the year looks kind of promising. You've got a Monuments Men, which I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, the new George Clooney picture.
Yeah, with a stellar cast. Of course, the new Wes Anderson, that looks like a lot of fun. So there's all these things that are upcoming. And even though I know that 2013 had a slow start, like we still don't know what's waiting for us in like the winter, like fall season of 2014. So if it's anything like this year, I welcome it.
Always go in with an open mind and high hopes. My name is Justin The Clue.
I'm Pierce Dirks.
And you've been listening to the Laser Blast Film Society podcast.